From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Since Plato wrote about the lost city of Atlantis in 360 BC, tales of a sophisticated society wiped out by catastrophe and sunken into the sea have captivated generations. It's been depicted as a magical underwater city in movies and books. The search for the real Atlantis continues all over the globe, and author Mark Adams has been on the hunt. This hour on Point, the ongoing search for the lost city of Atlantis. You can join us on air or online. What's your question about the lost city of Atlantis? Do you think it's out there? Have you thought about trying to track it down? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York City is Mark Adams. His new book is Meet Me in Atlantis, My Obsessive Quest to Find the Sunken City. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Mark, welcome back to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Good to be here.
So to some, Atlantis is a myth. To others, it's a very serious mystery to be solved. Tell us about your obsession with Atlantis. How did it begin? What attracted you to the quest?
Well, you know, as a kid, I was a big fan of the late Leonard Nimoy's show In Search Of. You may recall that one from
Yes.
the 80s. You know, he would go off in search of you know, Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster. And you would find these stories that were probably not entirely true, but they may have had this kernel of truth inside of them. And over my whole career, I found myself, you know, following this sort of obsessive story and trying to, you know, pull out the truth behind the legend. And inevitably, I guess that leads to Atlantis.
So when did Plato write about Atlantis and where does it appear in his writings?
Well, it's very interesting. He seems to have written it, and nothing about Plato is absolutely certain. He seems to have written it around 360 BC. And what is especially interesting about its placement is that it comes at the beginning of a work called the Timaeus, which is a very important work, probably the most important philosophical work during the Middle Ages. If you look at the famous fresco that Raphael did called School of Athens, at the center you'll see Aristotle on one side and Plato on the other, and tucked under Plato's arm is a copy of the Timaeus. Mm. It's essentially his attempt to give some sort of mathematical logic to the universe, you know. Pretty deep stuff, huh? Mm. And it follows the Republic, which is arguably the most influential work in Western civilization. Linking these two works is the first part of the story of Atlantis, the city that sank under the sea. So obviously the next question is, what is it doing there?
Right. So answer it. What is it? What is it doing there?
I don't know
there?
If I have enough time to answer that one, Jay. But, you know, basically, I think it's his way of inviting people in. And remember, Plato was a teacher. He was teaching this at the world's first university, the Academy that he founded in Athens. And I think it's kind of an invitation into this very deep philosophy. And Plato is you know, not only an incredible thinker, he's a great storyteller. You know, people remember things like the, you know, the myth of the cave and things like that. The ship of state was one of Plato's great images. So, you know, he's good at pulling people in and then making them grapple with some ideas that, you know, make your head feel like it's silly putty.
What did you mean when you said at the very beginning, nothing about Plato is certain?
Well, we're not absolutely certain what order he wrote the works in. We don't know exactly when he was born and when he was died. We just have a pretty good idea. You know, Plato was writing at a time when, you know, he's grappling with a brand new technology that he seems to have had some difficulties with, which is written history. You
right.
know, Herodotus had just invented history basically about 100 years earlier. And he talks about this a lot in his works. He says, you know, look, and, you know, Socrates always gets the best lines in Plato. And, you know, Socrates says something to the effect of, you know, look, I don't really trust written history because you can't argue with it. You know, to me, speech and you know, stuff like that is much better for philosophy because it's, you know, it's something you can engage with. It's not something it's just thrown at you.
So I want you to describe Atlantis. First, I'm going to play a little sound here from a secret history documentary on Atlantis. This is Princeton professor of classics, Alexander Nahamis, says that Atlantis seems real in part because the detail Plato uses to describe it is so vivid.
He tells us about the flowers, the plants, the kind of metals the people use, the kind of the way that each canal and each channel is built. He puts in elephants. In fact, it's only the second time that they're mentioned in Greek literature when Plato describes Atlantis. What does all that piling up of detail and very strange detail do? Well, it does two things. First, it makes it very exotic and something very strange. But because there's so much of it, it also makes it seem real.
Exotic, strange, the city with concurrent rings in the pillars of Hercules. Tell us about how Plato describes it.
Well, the professor is absolutely right. The reason why people have always felt like they could go out and search for Atlantis is because Plato gives such an incredibly vivid description. He gives dozens of characteristics. He talks about, you know, measurements. He gives actual numbers. He talks about landmarks. He talks about building materials. He talks about the island's position relative to other known places like the Pillars of Hercules. He talks about the three concentric rings of land and water and the gold statuary and the temple to Poseidon. It's an incredibly – it's almost like, reading something out of a travel guide. It sounds like the kind of place you would want to go visit. There's, you know, amazing mountains to the north that block these northerly winds, and there's this enormous plain that is crisscrossed with these wide canals. It's almost like he's tempting people by setting out this mystery with all these clues and saying, okay, solve it.
So it's essentially a story about a moral or spiritual people who lived in a highly advanced utopian civilization, but were eventually – they became greedy and morally bankrupt and were destroyed by fire and earthquakes, and then Atlantis fell into the sea. It sunk into the sea, right?
Right. Plato says in a grievous day and night – earthquakes and floods destroyed the city. Yeah.
And so there's a wide range of theories about it, about Atlantis, put forth by serious archaeologists as well as real crackpot sleuths, right? So help us understand what's out there, the spectrum.
Well, probably what most people think they know about Atlantis is that it sank to the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. And that is because in 1882, there was sort of an oddball Minnesota ex-congressman named Ignatius Donnelly who picked up on some of the first ocean surveys in the 19th century and used these as evidence. And then he sort of cherry-picked every other bit and piece of ancient evidence he could find and crammed it into this book called Atlantis, the Antediluvian World. And this is the book that sort of launches Atlantology, the search for Atlantis. And he says, you know, look, it was a super technologically advanced society that sank to the bottom of the ocean. And now in the Azores, you can see the very tips of Atlantis's mountains above the water now. Most of this is just sort of him spinning his wheels. Mm-hmm. Plato doesn't say a lot of this stuff. What we do know about Atlantis is that it's a war story. It's a naval battle between Atlantis, which, as you said, was, you know, sort of an excellent maritime culture that sort of degraded over time, and Athens. And Athens are the heroes. It's kind of like Star Wars. Athens are the rebels. And, you know, Athens defeats Atlantis, and then they both are hit by this cataclysm, whatever it is.
All right. I want to ask you about some of the theories about where Atlantis was or is located, if in fact it ever existed. In a 2014 National Geographic documentary on Atlantis, different teams of archaeologists searched for Atlantis based on clues in Plato's writings. And archaeologist Richard Frund believes that Atlantis was located in an ancient bay now covered by marsh.
Here we are in the largest marsh in southern Spain, hundreds of square miles. It is massive. We're talking about 40, 50 miles worth of just marsh. And archaeologists think that buried in this marsh is the lost city of Atlantis.
So location theories, Mark Adams, vary from Morocco to Spain to Malta to Greece. Tell us about it.
Okay. Well, what I did was I came up with four theories that sounded most reasonable to me. I mean, if you took out a world map and tried to stick a pin in every place that someone has proposed that Atlantis might have sunk, you'd run out of space,
right?
Space and pins pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So I had to, you know, limit it down to four. And Spain, as Professor Freund says there, is definitely one of them. You know, the thing that is appealing about Spain is its location. You know, Plato says in the second half of the story, which is in a dialogue called the Critias, that Atlantis was opposite the Pillars of Hercules and that it was near a place called Gades, which is the ancient Phoenician name for Cadiz, a city which is now in southern Spain. So it seems to be strong evidence that it might have been there. Mm. You know, that said, He also talks about an island rich in temples that is hit by a watery cataclysm, which is an excellent description of Malta, where the earliest temples in the Mediterranean were built, mm-hmm. freestanding temples, 1,000 years older than even the Great Pyramid of Giza. And Malta seems to have been hit by a watery cataclysm around 2500 BC. So that's a great candidate. The sort of, you know, Academy's candidate for Atlantis is the island of Santorini in Greece, and that's because it has the concentric ring shape because it basically blew sky high around 1600 BC, leaving this sort of donut shape with a small island in the middle. And they also, in 1967, found an ancient maritime city there called Akrotiri, and there was a fresco along three walls in this town of Akrotiri, which seemed to be very technologically advanced, that some have interpreted as an image of the city of Atlantis. The fourth category, which a lot of people, to my surprise, have found most convincing. I met a fellow named Michael Huebner in Germany, and he's an IT specialist who took every detail he could find in Plato's Atlantis stories, plugged it into this sort of statistical analysis, and then his computer sort of chugged out at the end that the only place it ever could have been. And he told me, you know, this is with 99.99% accuracy, that it was near the city of Agadir on the Atlantic coast of Morocco.
Where do you think?
You know, I don't want to give away the ending. I don't want to be that
guy
who comes out of the crying game and says, you know, she's a dude!
All right, Mark Adams, author of Meet Me in Atlantis, My Obsessive Quest to Find the Sunken City. We'll stick with you. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're speaking with author Mark Adams this hour about the search for the lost city of Atlantis and his journey into that remarkable world. The music we heard was from the 2001 movie Atlantis, The Lost Empire. Mark Adams is with us. He's got this new book, Meet Me in Atlantis, My Obsessive Quest to Find the Sunken City. It's quite a read. Here's some more sound about theories that the island of Atlantis that Plato described could be known to us by other names. Some archaeologists imagine that this culture known as Minoa could be Plato's Atlantis. Here the narrator of the National Geographic Atlantis documentary describes the similarities between Minoa and Atlantis.
The cultural importance of the bull, the stunning architecture, the depictions of a utopian lifestyle, together paint a familiar picture. It seems possible that the people we call Minoans are really the long-lost people of Atlantis.
So, Mark Adams, is there any evidence that from any other source that the legend of Atlantis existed before Plato wrote about it?
Well, there's no mention of Atlantis by that name. And the reason for that is Plato says very clearly in the Atlantis story, he says, look, I got this story from my great-great-great-great-grandfather, Solon, who's kind of like the Thomas Jefferson of Athens, where we get the word Solonic. He went to Egypt and he heard it from a priest who saw it preserved in their temples, and then I changed all the names into Greek. So, you know, any theory that says I'm going to find a place called Atlantis doesn't make any sense because it could have been named anything except Atlantis. Mm-hmm. You know, that said, there are a lot of pieces of ancient history that seem to coincide with the Atlantis story, and the Minoan theory is one of them. Minoans, of course, are you know, a culture that lived on Crete, and we didn't know anything about them until the early 20th century when Arthur Evans, the great archaeologist, went over there and found the Palace of Knossos. You know, my thinking is that people maybe read a little too much into it. You heard that guy there talking about bulls and things. Mm-hmm. You know, red, white, and black stone Plato describes in Atlantis. These are things that show up all around the Mediterranean. So I think that if you're going to follow those kinds of clues, you might not get too far.
A lot of callers want to get in here with you, Mark Adams. Here's Matt in Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Matt. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Go ahead.
All right. I was wondering if you had researched any other lost continents that were supposed to have existed around the same time, such as
I did.
Lemuria or I think it's pronounced Mu or Mu.
Right, right. Mu was something that was invented by the theosophist Madame Blavatsky, as far as I know. There's no any sort of evidence that Mu ever really existed. And Lemuria was actually a zoological concept that somebody cooked up to explain the fact that there were lemurs in both India and Madagascar, I believe. They thought, okay, maybe there is some sunken continent in the Indian Ocean. Nobody believes that Lemuria ever really existed, but these concepts have lived on, and there are a lot of people who believe that they know where they were.
Matt, thanks so much for the call. Mark Adams, some historians believe that Plato used the story of Atlantis simply as a literary device to convey some of his philosophical theories, if you will. And there's certainly evidence that Plato liked to play practical jokes, mathematical jokes on his students. Couldn't Atlantis be one of them?
You know, it could be, and I absolutely think that Plato hid a lot of mathematics in a lot of his writings, and especially the Timaeus. But it seems awfully odd that he would stick a practical joke between the Republic and the Timaeus. It's just a very strange place for him to put it. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it just makes for a very odd segue between two such important works.
Two of the arguably the most influential works in Western civilization.
Exactly.
Could it be his way of warning people of their eventual collapse? I mean, it could be an allegory here. There could be a lot in here. I'm just trying to poke holes in this in any way I can.
Absolutely. Well, that's the thing about Plato. You can read into it. It's like the story of Atlantis. People read into the story of Atlantis what they want. It's like a blank slate. And whatever they want to see in Atlantis, they do see. And, you know, Plato, there's a lot of that going on in him as well. You know, the Republic, you know, talk about interpreting Plato in different ways. You know, the Republic is a foundational text of both Christianity and fascism. So you can read all sorts of things into Plato if you want to. But as for, you know, warning, I think that's definitely a case. I think Plato is saying, you know, look, sophisticated cultures, civilizations, don't realize that the bigger they get, the more powerful they get. They're still headed for some sort of cataclysm, be it natural disaster or whatever. You know, he talks about comets hitting the earth. He mm-hmm. talks about three great floods that have, you know, wiped out civilization in the past. He talks about, you know, when the Greeks lost writing for a long time. And some people believe that might be a reference to the Dark Ages when the Greeks lost the linear B that showed up at Knossos when Arthur Evans started digging there. You know, so I do think there is, you know, at least an element of warning in the Atlantis story. You know, hey, the bigger you get, the harder you fall.
Here's Ray in Miami, Florida. Hi, Ray. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
So my question has to do with something that, I've read a lot of Plato, and Alexander the Great was like one of my heroes as a kid, and it kind of occurred to me, and then I looked it up, and it seems that at least some people believe that Alexander the Great might have been looking for Atlantis way back when, because, as we all know, Aristotle was Alexander's teacher, and, well, Aristotle was
student of Plato,
student,
right?
So, I've actually seen a mural where it supposedly depicts Alexander the Great in a diving bell, or some primitive form of that. I just wondered if you had anything to say about that, if you've run across that.
I haven't come across any direct Alexander the Great references, and I don't know the diving bell mural that you talk about. But I can say that one of the great topics of debate in Atlantology is whether Aristotle said that Plato made up Atlantis or whether he actually supported it. And I've seen a good case on each side.
Well, wasn't the quote exactly, Mark, "He who invented Atlantis also destroyed it"? That's what Aristotle
said.
Right,
but he said. He didn't actually say that verbatim. That is a later commentator on the dialogues who sort of took two pieces and
put
stuck
them together.
Uh-huh. Yeah. He said something kind of similar to that, but he was actually talking about another theory of Plato's, the theory of forms, which is where we get the idea of the Platonic ideal where something is perfect and exists beyond space and time. But, you know, Aristotle may or may not have supported you know, Plato's theory. But in the next generation of students at the Academy, there was a fellow named Crantor, who is famous for writing the first commentaries on Plato's dialogue, and is also generally believed to have sent someone to Egypt to try to prove that Plato's Atlantis story was true. So, you know, we've been debating this going all the way back to pretty much when Plato died around 347 BC.
So, Mark Adams, your investigation of this ancient city of Atlantis took you around the globe. It's quite a travelogue. Tell us about the meeting you had in Greece where you met the so-called king of Atlantology who explained to you the numerical and musical codes hidden in Plato's writings. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Stavros Papamarinopoulos, he's a geophysicist. He's a very esteemed geophysicist. He actually found proof of a story that Herodotus told that a lot of people thought was too incredible to be true. It was that Xerxes, the king of the Persians, had dug a canal across the Mount Athos Peninsula in Greece wide enough for two warships to pass each other. And he actually used, you know, ground-penetrating radar and other geophysical methods to prove that the story was true. He is sort of a lone wolf who's been trying to find the bits of truth in the Atlantis story for, you know, I don't know, I think it's 40 years or so, and he holds triennial Atlantis conferences. And he was the first person to point out to me, you know, look, Plato, he wrote, you know, written word as a story, but he also had mathematical codes in his works, and he also had musical codes in his works. Remember, Plato was a Pythagorean. He studied with Pythagoreans in southern Spain when he went on what was essentially a study abroad trip after Socrates was forced to drink hemlock in 399 BC, and he picked up a lot of their mathematics-based philosophy. Mm. So, you know, there has not been a lot of research into this. I am certainly not an expert in the Pythagorean roots of Plato's philosophy.
But he was Mr. Math. I mean,
he, you know, this over the Academy in Athens, there supposedly was a sign that said, none but geometers may enter here. And they did teach a Pythagorean curriculum. We know that.
Let's get Jeff in here from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jane.
Hi.
I was also a big fan of the Leonard Nimoy show In Search Of, and obviously the one with Edward Casey talking about Atlantis being found in his lifetime, and then the Heinrich Schliemann finding Troy based on Homer. Pretty cool. But I'm actually calling about the connection to copper mining. State Park near Madison called Ostalon, used for copper. Then obviously the copper culture, the first cemetery in America outside of Green Bay, and then Isle Royale up in Lake Superior. So I'm just kind of wondering, perhaps the copper from Lake Superior fueled the Bronze Age of Europe. Any of those connections have you found or anything?
Jeff, thank you.
Well, yeah, I mean, that is still kind of an out there theory. I mean, for those people who don't know, there's an island called Isle Royale in, I believe, Lake Superior, where supposedly a huge amount of very pure copper deposits is missing, and nobody can explain why they don't show up in the native culture nearby there. And there's a theory, because Plato mentions in the Atlantis story that Atlantis was on the way to other islands and then a true continent across the boundless sea. Some people think that that is a reference to America and that, you know, maybe people going over to get copper and coming back can be the purpose for that part of the story. You know, the problem with that theory is that there's an island in the Mediterranean called Cyprus, and Cyprus means copper. So there's a huge island of copper, you know, within, say, 200 miles of ancient Greece. And it's not as pure as the copper all the way across the ocean, but it certainly does make one raise an eyebrow and say, well, why would they go all the way across the ocean to dig a metal when they've got this huge chunk of copper not far from home?
Have there been any clues, any discoveries at all that lend credence to the mystery of Atlantis?
Well, there are some that could lend credence. You know, I mentioned before, in 1967, they found the city of Akrotiri buried on Santorini, which is the island with the sort of ring shape. That fresco could be evidence of Atlantis. You know, more compelling is probably there is a hieroglyph in one of the mortuary temples in Egypt, which describes what's known to historians as the Sea People's Invasion, which happened around 1177 BC. And there's a lot of thinking. It's for decades, serious academics have entertained this idea that this Sea People's Invasion, where people came in ships from the distant Mediterranean and attacked Egypt, somehow was turned into the story of this Atlantis Navy coming and attacking Athens, and that Plato's ancestor Solon had picked up that story in the temples and brought it back to Athens, and somehow details got twisted along the way.
So interesting. Will is calling from Middleton, Wisconsin. Hi, Will. Welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
I was fortunate enough to be born in northeastern Minnesota near Isle Royal. As you probably know, the copper from Isle Royal, they have, I don't know how, the carbon 14 or however it is, that copper is found in the Near East. So apparently they did mine it and bring it to the Near East. But anyway, what I want to get to is I was born into a family that had, I had two mother tongues, English and Finnish. I submit that the Proto-Finno-Ugric language, we don't know exactly where it rose, but may have arisen north of the Black Sea. But some speculate it rose in North Africa. In any event, I submit that Atlantis is a Finno-Ugric word. Etela. Etela means south. Atlantis, land. Land west. Etela landen. In other words, to the southwest. I submit that Atlantis was, according to that ancient Proto-Finno-Ugric language, a high civilization to the southwest of where the Finno-Ugrics were speaking their tongue. Moreover, and then I'll end up, Egypt is Aika Pitaya, age, keeper. Pitaya is keeper, where they kept the clock in a stone pyramid clock. And, you know, I could go on and on, but it's very, very interesting. I submit that that Atlantis was somewhere to the southwest of wherever the Finns, Finno-Ugric, wrote that tale of Atlantis.
All right, Will, thank you. Mark Adams, what do you think?
Well, I have to say, I can't disprove your theory. I'll put that out there. But as I mentioned before, Plato does say that his ancestor Solon brought the story back and changed all the names. So the only thing we know about Atlantis is that it wasn't called Atlantis. It had some other name beforehand. You know, a lot of people have dug out, you know, names that sound like Atlantis, especially from like Mayan glyphs and things like that. And, you know, it's just not really that useful to me because we don't have any example of the Atlantean language. You know, it's basically a history that doesn't have that kind of detail in it.
Let me get another quick call here before the break. John in Fairhaven, Massachusetts is on the line. John, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. How's it going?
Hi, well, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm interested. Glenn Milne, a geologist, he made some inundation maps a few years back. And for the end of the last ice age, and what he showed was that right about the same time that Plato says Atlantis went under, there was a huge outburst of glacial water. So I'm wondering if that's been taken into consideration in this.
John, thank you. That when the ice melted, Atlantis went underwater, Mark Adams?
Yeah, this is a pretty major point that comes up again and again. I think around 9600 BC, Plato says, you know, this story, which Solon got around 600 BC, supposedly happened 9,000 years ago. So that would take it to 9600 BC, which correlates pretty closely with the end of the last ice age, lots of melting, seas rising. The problem with that is, you know, we don't have any evidence that there was the sort of sophisticated civilization that Plato describes in 9600 BC. A lot of people have come up with theories trying to bend those numbers, saying that, well, actually, the person wrote it down wrong in Egypt, and instead of 1,000, he meant 100, which would mean it was actually 1,500, which coincides with the Santorini explosion. Other people have said they're talking about a lunar calendar, so it's, you know, 9,600 divided by 12 months. You know, I just don't know. I don't know what to make of it.
Mark Adams, author of Meet Me in Atlantis, My Obsessive Quest to Find the Sunken City. Stand by. We're discussing the mystery around Plato's lost city of Atlantis, and you can join us. We'll go out with Atlantis by Donovan off the 1969 album. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking with Mark Adams about his new book, Meet Me in Atlantis, My Obsessive Quest to Find the Sunken City, and you can join the conversation. Have you thought about searching for the lost city of Atlantis? In 2001, Disney made the movie Atlantis, The Lost Empire. The main character, Milo, voiced by Michael J. Fox, discovers a journal that he believes will guide him to Atlantis. Here, in a submarine on the way to find the city, he describes the path to the island.
See, according to the journal, the path to Atlantis will take us down a tunnel at the bottom of the ocean and will come up a curve into an air pocket right here, where we'll find the remnants of an ancient highway that will lead us to Atlantis.
Mark Adams, a lot of calls here. Let's go to Sal in Wittensville, Massachusetts. Sal, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi, Mark. Mark, what do you think about Professor Santa's book about Atlantis being finally found in the Indies, that we have it all wrong, that we're looking and we're reading about things that have been so miscued over the years, that all our clues are right in the legends that we read about in myths that are around us today. And he also brings it out to the fact that this all occurred during the last ice age, that there was tumultuous volcanic activity in that area, Krakatoa, as we know. I just wondered if you had read this book or look at this, and what do you think about it?
You know, I know a little bit about the theory. The thing that I used as a cutoff when I was looking for possible locations for Atlantis is this naval battle that takes place between Atlantis and Athens. You know, I don't know how an armada is supposed to get from Indonesia or the Caribbean or Bolivia, you know, or you know, any of these super distant locations and, you know, provision hundreds of thousands of sailors, as Plato says, and get them all the way across the Atlantic or Pacific and then through the Mediterranean all the way to Athens to have this battle. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me that it would be anywhere really outside the Mediterranean.
Mark Adams, you share some interesting historical facts in the book, one of which was that some Nazis actually believed the German people could be traced back to Atlantis and sponsored expeditions to search for it in the 1930s. Would you tell us about that?
Yeah. I mean, Heinrich Himmler was the head of a group called the Annenerbe, and their role was to come up with some sort of Aryan mythology to give, a fake ancient basis to the Germanic peoples. And they actually went out in search of relics that could prove these theories. And one of the stories that they went after was Atlantis. And they were actively searching for Atlantis and had planned a major expedition in 1939 to go to the Canary Islands, which was put off only because the Nazis decided to invade Poland instead.
Mm. I'm curious what you make of all the effort and the human longing to rediscover this lost world of Atlantis. After all your study and research, all the people you've talked to, what do you make of it?
Well, first of all, I have to say, you know, I started researching the book very skeptical. And by the end, I had been almost completely sucked in because it is such a wonderful story. There is such wonderful detail. Plato is such a great writer. And, you know, he is essentially throwing out this treasure map and saying, okay, it's a puzzle hidden inside a treasure map saying, okay, find the part that's true and find the part that's false. And as one archaeologist who does not believe in Atlantis told me, you know, it's a utopia. Everybody wants to believe in a utopia. And I think that that's part of the search. You know, people just want to believe in this lost world that, you know, exemplifies whatever it is that we want it to be.
Here's Troy in Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Troy. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thanks, Jane.
Sure.
I had read a book a few years ago. I forget who the authors were, but two different scientists who had developed a theory that the book is called Noah's Flood, by the way, but the theory they developed was that rising sea levels in the Mediterranean in ancient times broke a land barrier that led to what we now know as the Straits of Bosporus, and that evidence they'd found of fresh water under the Black Sea, freshwater mollusks, fossils, and things like that, had indicated that a massive flood of salt water from the Mediterranean had flooded into that area. And in sending down things like the Alvin, they'd found evidence of people that had lived along the ancient shoreline of that lake. And what they proposed in Noah's flood was that these people may have domesticated animals. They may have even settled down with food crops and had sophisticated language. And the rising levels would have spread out around the perimeter of the lake, driving them in different directions. And they would have gone into different areas, carrying with them the memory of the flood. And they suggested that the people that ended up down in the area of Egypt would have carried that along, and the seasonal floods of the Nile would have reinforced that and eventually led to the story in the Bible of Noah's flood.
And, and you're wondering perhaps if they're related, Troy? Is that the question?
Yeah. It occurred to me that you would have had a narrow area there like the Pillars of Hercules, and you would have had a flooding of what could have been the most advanced civilization at that time.
Troy, thank you. What do you think, Mark Adams?
Well, I know the theory. It's a couple of guys at Columbia. I can't think of their names right now, but they say that around 5600 BC, the water rose in the Mediterranean, breached the Bosphorus, the land bridge between Greece and Turkey there, and spilled over and fairly rapidly, not instantly, but you know, over a matter of months and years, the level of the Black Sea rose very high. And I think Bob Ballard, one of the fellows who found the Titanic, actually went in there and did some research and did find that there were some civilizations and evidence of fresh water, I think a couple hundred feet below. As for Noah's flood, it's possible. You know, almost every ancient culture has some sort of flood myth, and it ties into this, what we were talking about before, with Plato warning about cataclysms coming, you know, again and again and again. There's actually a very interesting theory that someone presented to me that a lot of these flood myths, we're talking Noah's Ark, we're talking Atlantis, we're talking about the flood of Deucalion that comes up in Greek mythology, and the Epic of Gilgamesh, probably the oldest of them all, they're very similar. They have a lot of details in common, and it's theoretically possible that they could all be traced back to a single cometary impact in the Indian Ocean around 2807 BC. There's actually a crater at the bottom of the Indian Ocean that they're thinking might be evidence that this comet crashed and caused not only a huge wave like a bowling ball dropped into a bathtub, but because it was coming and it was so hot, it vaporized water into the atmosphere. And what would happen, you would get, say, 40 days and 40 nights of rain.
Well, and Troy's question, Mark, makes me wonder about, you know, the age of Google Earth and the advances in oceanography. How has technology changed the way you and others search for Atlantis?
Well, what has changed is that now anybody sitting at home at his desk or, you know, in her armchair can search satellite images around the world. But one of the things that got me started on this book was I was working at National Geographic, I think it was in 2009, and it was the day Google Earth debuted. And all of a sudden, the email box started filling up with people writing in saying, I found Atlantis. No, I found Atlantis. No, I found Atlantis. And it turned out that some ship's sonar had left a little grid in the Caribbean that Google forgot to erase, and they got rid of it after a few hours. But for a while there, the internet was lighting up with people saying, I found Atlantis!
Let's get Joe in here from Richmond, Virginia. Hi, Joe. Thanks for calling. You're on.
Thank you. I was just curious as to whether anyone along the way has considered that Plato's references were simply allegorical in terms of faith and heaven and the quest for perfection.
Hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. As I mentioned before, Plato's, theory of forms, where there is this other world. There's another example of everything we know of. We see a horse on Earth, but it's actually just sort of a lousy rendition of the perfect form of the horse that exists outside space and time. Like I said, Plato can be interpreted in any number of ways, and he's a very slippery person to try to nail to the wall.
So you wouldn't give it up at the beginning. Now is the time, Mark Adams. Is it true, Atlantis, or is it a bunch of hooey, or somewhere in the middle?
Well, I have to kick this one over to Socrates. Plato, he has Socrates say in the Republic, he says, there are stories that are true, and there are stories that are false, and there are stories that are false but have some truth in them. And, you know, at the risk of correcting Socrates, I think he's got it backwards. I think there are stories that are essentially true but have some falsehoods in them. And I think that's what Atlantis is in the end.
Hmm. What are you looking for next?
I don't know. But having written a book about Machu Picchu followed by a book about Atlantis, I'm pretty sure it's not going to be a lost city.
From crop circles to the Loch Ness Monster to the Bermuda Triangle to Atlantis.
Exactly. Yeah, my agent called the other day. She's like, I got it. Anchor Wat.
Mark Adams, thank you very much for your time. What a really interesting book, Meet Me in Atlantis, My Obsessive Quest to Find the Sunken City. For an excerpt, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Mark Adams, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jane. This is fun.
In a moment, we'll look at the big fossil discovery that's shedding new light on the origins of humans. This is On Point. Two years ago, in Ethiopia, a graduate student of Arizona State University came across a fossil, a 2.8 million-year-old lower jawbone. The findings, published last week, are shaking up evolutionary science. It's now the earliest known Homo habilis fossil, predating previously known Homo fossils by about 400,000 years. With us now from Phoenix, Arizona, is William Kimball. He's director of the Institute of Human Origins at Arizona State University. He's one of the authors on the study published last week in the Journal of Science. So nice to have you with us, William.
Pleasure to be with you, Jane.
So tell us about this discovery. Where exactly was it made and by whom?
The discovery was made by, as you pointed out, a young Ethiopian graduate student of ours here at ASU, a man by the name of Chelacho Sayum, who was with one of the Institute's projects at a place called Lady Gararu, not very far from the Lucy site in the Afar Rift Valley of Ethiopia.
Lucy site, which was the famous place where the ape-like specimen was discovered a few years ago?
The ape-like human ancestor specimen, very well known, was found back in the 1970s, only about 12 or 13 miles away. This student was out on a daily survey with a fossil hunting team and happened across this jaw on the surface of 2.8 million-year-old rocks that are exposed today in this area.
So how big is it? Explain, describe what it looks like.
Well, it's not that much bigger. It's a half of a jaw with about five or six teeth in it, and it's not that much bigger than our own jaws, certainly more robustly constructed, consistent with its great age. But its importance lies in the fact that it helps us document one of the prevailing mysteries in our own descent from an African ape-like ancestor. And that's the origin of the genus Homo, the genus to which our own species, Homo sapiens, belongs.
So this now is the oldest human genus Homo that we have, right? It predates fossils of its kind by about, what, 400,000 years?
About 400,000 to 500,000 years, that's right. So prior to 2.8 million years ago, we have early Australopithecus, the genus to which Lucy belongs, and is well represented in this area. From about 3 million years back to about 3.6 or 3.7 million years. Mm. And then if we jump about a million years ahead, seems like a fantastic amount of time, but in geological time it's not so big, we have in Eastern Africa multiple species of human ancestors that are attributed to our own genus, Homo habilis, Homo erectus, Homo rudolfensis. They go by these names. And these are species with large brains relative to Australopithecus. They appear to have been tool-making for the purposes of meat protein consumption. Hmm. And at least one of them has a much more human-like body build with longer lower limbs, legs like ours. And the point has been that the time period between 2 million years and Lucy's era around 3 million years is not very well represented in the fossil record, and that may come as somewhat of a surprise to your listeners. But teams all over Eastern and Southern Africa have been targeting this area to try to increase the fossil yield to gain some clues as to how, when, where our own genus arose. And this jaw puts a dent in that search by pushing back the earliest evidence by about 400,000 years, just a couple hundred thousand years after the last known of Lucy's species. And so it narrows the gap between our ultimate ancestor in Lucy-like creatures and the later, larger brain tool-using species of the genus Homo.
So what is significant about this location? We found this particular jawbone, same place as the famous ape-like specimen Lucy that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. What's significant about this place, this location?
It's one, well, in general, the Afar area of Ethiopia is one of the richest sources of human ancestral fossils in Africa and indeed the world. And there are at least five teams working in different regions of the Afar Rift Valley. The area where this jaw was found in 2013, known as Lady Gararu, is quite rich in places.
Mm-hmm.
And so the teams are out there looking for additional fossils in this time period. In fact, I just returned from the site barely 2 weeks ago. And so there are, you know, we're still out there looking.
Well, it sounds very exciting. Thank you very much for being with us. Are you optimistic you might find more?
Oh, yes, very much so.
William Kimball is the director of the Institute of Human Origin at Arizona State University. William, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it. Good luck.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow, 33-year-old composer Nico Muhly has turned the classical world on its head with the sound of drones and the web and the world right now. He'll join us for that. Tom's back tomorrow. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.